Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foyt. We have a full house tonight. Nick Osello, Larkin Kemp, and more games than we have time to discuss. Boys, how are we doing?
I'm doing wonderful, Terry. This is the best slate that I've seen in a long time, and I just want to get ahead of it now. There's going to be people who say, oh, you didn't spend enough time on insert their preferred game. Well, sorry, there were a lot of really good games, and I'm excited to talk about them. Larkin, how are you?
Special weekend of lacrosse. Not much going on in the world otherwise, so just really could focus on the slate, which is great. I'm fantastic.
Well said. Well said. So, you know, fellas, we obviously had this quadrant of Syracuse, Carolina, Princeton, Penn, and we're going to get to that. We could be talking about Dom Petromala, Joey Spallina, you know, the stars of the game, the stars of tomorrow. But we are going to start with a sophomore fourth team face-off specialist for Johns Hopkins, a Mercer transfer from North Carolina, Carter Krizek. Because if you thought that was the place that we were going to be starting this podcast on Friday, you would be, if you said that, you'd be lying. So this is the catalyst for Johns Hopkins' epic comeback. Face-off guy comes in, completely changes the balance and the tenor of the contest. But it's not just that. This is the beauty of sports and the beauty in particular of college sports. Carter Krizek's family home, his childhood home, burned down on Wednesday night. 11:30 p.m., his dad just sees a glow in the backyard and manages to get his mom, a sibling, two dogs out of the house. By the time the fire department shows up, everything is destroyed. The cars are melted. And they're like, yeah, we're coming to Charlottesville because we're staying in a hotel. What else are we going to do? There's a GoFundMe to help defray the expenses for the Krizek family. We've got a sophomore transfer who in Hopkins' first three games had taken a total of 16 faceoffs. Griff Meyer is absolutely dominating. And Carter Krizek comes in, wins the first faceoff clean. And then from that point forward, finishes 7-12 with five ground balls, and Hopkins pulls off the comeback of the season. Nick, I can tell by your face you've got something to say. Your thoughts?
So this is my favorite game I've watched in a long time, and it wasn't because of the level of execution. I'll say that. There were a lot of moments in this game where it almost turned into youth soccer match territory. 15-second ground balls with, you know, four players on each side, not being able to scoop it up, bad passes, you know, open man to open man, just kind of airmailing it or throwing it down at the knees. And it's exactly why I love college sports above professional sports, pretty much at every angle. You can have the moments that, you know, they're human, they're really damn good players, but they can sink to a level that make you scratch your head at certain times. And I was curious because Hopkins and Virginia, you know, obviously they don't like each other. I'm not going to put Kyle Harrison on blast, but he was telling me that he actually just really doesn't like Virginia above all others. And that's kind of, you know, shared throughout the Hopkins DNA. Hey, we have our rivalries, but Virginia, we just hate as much as anybody else. And I thought that there was something extra that Hopkins had because as they started to mount their comeback, I was like, I've seen juiced up sidelines. I almost thought that the bench was just going to pull, you know, let's charge into the stands and fight everybody in Charlottesville. We're beyond fired up. And now knowing that their star unsung heroes face-off house burnt down, which I mean, as far as catastrophic disasters go, house fires is like top three for me. That's like what I'm most scared of in life. More than an avalanche, more than a tornado, more than a hailstorm. A house fire? Are you kidding me? It was one of the best games I've seen in a long, long time. It was sloppy. It was beautiful. UVA's defense, all they had to do was not piss down their leg on the backside, and they pissed down their leg on 12 possessions in a row. I loved everything about it. And I'm fired up just even thinking about what was going on in the locker room after the game.
Larkin, UVA built a 9-3 lead. In the first half, Hopkins got three saves in the first quarter, zero in the second. They cleared the ball twice in the first quarter, one failed. Five times in the second quarter, one failed. Virginia failed, one clear as well. So when you add that with the three face-off wins that they had, that means that they had a total of 11 possessions and scored 3 goals. So, you know, not great efficiency, but certainly not like terrible. Like, you can win scoring 30% of your possessions. And then switch goaltenders, Orange Elias comes in. He was the starter for the second half of last season and played really well. Was definitely another factor in the outcome. One of the pivotal plays that I think helped in terms of the pressure that UVA was applying on their ride early in the third was when Liam Burke scored a long distance goal against an empty net. But UVA responded with 2 goals after that. So that wasn't the catalyst for the comeback. Trailing 10-4 and emerging, I guess it's kind of important to say the final score when we do these recaps, 14-13 victors over the Wahoos. What'd you take away from this one?
I mean, it was an incredible 2 hours of lacrosse. It's a game in which we'll have Lars in the Garden overnight from the infamous Ivy League tournament quote against Andy Shea back in the day. But I think what will sting is, frankly, UVA did a lot of things well. For the first time, in my opinion, their rope unit showed some flash. They had a pole goal. They should have had 2 more from Hublitz and Hopper. They didn't shoot particularly well. I felt like the faceoff unit was grinding, especially in the first 3 quarters. Defense was dramatically improved versus the film of Colgate and Richmond. Like, it's one of these games where UVA was frankly following their plan. Like, you know, Hausman with the goal and Tranny. I thought the Millens were doing a good job of drawing leverage and getting to good areas. You know, Dunkel with the flash in the first quarter. And to the Hopkins staff credit, to the kids credit, when you have a kid who can shoot the way Chauvette can, you're never really out of a game. Like, the nature of help fill leverage is, you know, people need to fill down. They need to rotate and fill. And, I mean, that kid can flat out fill it up, and UVA does not have great goaltending. But I think it says a lot about the belief that that bench has in the plan, in that it really felt like that thing was getting away. Like, early third, this was not one where Hopkins was getting a ton of great looks on offense, and you just felt like it was a levee that eventually would break. Like, UVA was playing structural, like, strong defense. And then there was a light switch moment. And from there, it just felt like UVA couldn't catch a break. But, I mean, just devastating for the UVA staff and that team. Because, frankly, there have been moments during this rivalry where we could pencil both the teams. You know, Nick referenced the Kyle days. Into, let's call it, not championship weekend, but like a quarterfinal seed line. I don't think that's the case with either of these groups. Like, this is a massive inflection moment in their potential journeys in RPI, where UVA's schedule is not actually that strong this year outside of their ACC games. So there's going to be a ton of now risk factor. Like, you're not going to gain anything beating Dartmouth or Utah or whatever, right? So they have to go on the road in some of these ACC games and win games this year to make the tournament. I'll pause there.
No question. And, you know, if you remember last year, it wasn't this early, but it wasn't that much later where it was just like, Virginia's already eliminated, right, from postseason contention just because there wasn't a pathway back. And I think that, your point is well taken. And I think the comment about crediting the staff, particularly for the standpoint of keeping the players' composure, I don't think belief is necessarily an issue, especially if you consider it a rivalry game, because, you know, belief is helpful when it comes to making sure that you don't give up, which I think is kind of what Hopkins would say happened against Carolina, right? That was a game like this one that was 12-8, third quarter going into the fourth quarter. There was so much more belief on the Hopkins sideline. And I think it was a reflection of the game flow, right? Like, Carolina scored twice to turn a 10-8 game into a 12-8 game in the last minute of the third quarter. And I think that took the wind out of Hopkins' sails. Whereas, you know, they had scored, I think, 4 straight to turn an 11-4 game into an 11-8 game. And then Virginia got one back, that pole goal in transition. But it was still, you know, enough to it was basically just, all right, it was one goal. We'll refocus and we'll get that back. And I do think that while it's too early to say and not true that the winner of this game now has a favorable path to an at-large bid. I think it is true to say that the loser has a very murky, if present, path. And so for Hopkins to avoid that when the calendar turns to March is certainly important for what that their fan base expects. Now, obviously, on the flip side, you know, we've talked over the last couple of years about how sneaky impressive the growing fan base for these games in Klockner has been. And for a team, you know, another team coming off of missing the NCAA tournament, the way that game turned is going to leave a bitter taste in that fan base's mouth for sure.
Totally aligned. Yeah, completely agreed.
All right. Like we said at the top, we've got a ton to get to. Just for context, we're currently recording this at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon Eastern time as the clock winds down in Duke's 12-6 win over St. Joe's. I don't think that one is going to make the slate. We are going to spend probably the next 25 or 30 minutes talking about that combination of Penn, Princeton, Carolina, and Syracuse. I think it probably makes sense to talk about those on the basis of the teams, right? As opposed to takeaways for each of the four squads, as opposed to talking about the games individually. You can, as a listener, consider that a production note for my co-host Nick, who's going to steer the ship on that one. But before we get to it, just quick recap. I spent two Friday and Saturday nights in the St. James in Springfield, Virginia at the PLL and WL Champs Series. Want to just shout that out, particularly as we are about an hour removed from the end of the Redwoods 23-21 overtime victory over the Carolina Chaos that sends them to 2-0 and gives them a catbird position heading into the final game of round robin play. In this format, the team who finishes atop the standings goes directly to the championship. Two plays three in the semifinals and four gets eliminated. Bitter pill to swallow for the Chaos, who fall to 0-2 but have lost a one goal game and an overtime game by a 2-point goal to Romar Dennis. But yeah, it was, I mean, I've said it on this podcast, I've said it privately and publicly before, Champ Series is one of the sneaky hidden gems of the entire sport. St. James is such an awesome venue because of where the seating is. The PLL has done such a good job in closing the three sides that don't have permanent stands. And, you know, a 70 by 35 yard field is just such a conducive viewing environment. It looks great on TV. It's even better when you're there. So certainly would recommend anybody in the Mid-Atlantic region to take a look at the scheduled games. I believe it's 6 and 8 on Thursday, equivalent times on Friday. And then we've got staggered semifinals on Saturday, WL, PLL, afternoon, evening, and then championship games on Sunday. So head to PremierLacrosseLeague.com to check out tickets. And if you're not able to make it, make sure you hit the ESPN app to be able to watch. Did you guys get any eyes on the Champ Series? Your boy Dylan Malloy, he knows how to play sixes lacrosse.
It's that dad strength. He's got a baby girl now, and he's built different. Honestly, he's back in, like, you know, 2015 playing shape. He looks fantastic. He's good at sixes. He's pretty damn good at effectively anything with a lacrosse stick. So I'm glad the whole world.
Yeah, I was actually – I've kind of firmly landed on the spot that sixes is objectively a good thing, especially as we look at growing the youth pipeline and the international pipeline. And I was even getting into it with some burners on Twitter just for a little time sake this weekend. But I'm like, it is – it's fun to watch. I'm sorry. If you watch that and you are walking away with anything other than this is fun, you know, I got nothing for you. So it's become sneaky something I've paid a little bit more attention to it gradually every year. And I think this is the first year that I was actually excited to turn on some sixes and see the direct contrast between what we were watching in college and then what, you know, how goddamn good players are. Larkin, we played at the right time, and watching what guys can do these days, good. We got in while the getting was good, and we got out before we would be embarrassed. At least I'm speaking for myself. Larkin, you were certainly a stud in transition.
Well, that was what I was going to say. I chirped you last week. I'm going to take that back. I apologize. Also, Larkin, I think you would have been a really interesting player because there were only a handful of polls that were playing with shorties over the course of the week. And what do you think? Like, how do you feel like your game would have translated in the context of what would you have given up with the extra, you know, 2 feet not being on your stick relative to the Dito transition threat?
I think I would have been a pretty big disappointment because I can't. I think people would have assumed that my my offensive skill set would then lead to like value add, but I think I'd give up more on the defensive end. Like I was a stick based knockdown player, not a grind like chunk and run defender. So because of that, I'd be like probably worse than Dylan at like on ball defense, which would probably stun people. I not to chirp myself, but
appreciate the honesty. I mean, if you're listening and you just heard that, then you've got to believe that every take he's going to give about the college lacrosse that he watched over the course of the weekend is going to be completely objective and honest.
Yeah, and by the way, like there are amazing hockey players who don't play 3v3 in the Olympics, right? Like there are guys on the back end of the bench who are Olympians who like they would never have gone out there even if it had gone six overtime periods. So six is just a different sport. It's a different product. There's people who are elite at it and people whose skills don't translate.
Let's get into it. Nick Osello, let's start with the Princeton Tigers who went 2-0 over the course of the weekend.
I mean, they force teams into playing the blueprint that will lead Princeton to success. It's really impressive to watch because with wins over Syracuse and Carolina, you know, the thing that sticks out to me most is the progression at kind of how the game unfolds. They're really good at limiting your best player's ability to do what makes them the best player. Got an absolute rock star in Cage, and the variety with which their offense can score, and not just score, but throw different looks at you. It makes it really difficult for a defense to get progressively better against the Princeton offense over the game. And I think that's more rare for an offense in college lacrosse than you might think. You know, everybody can look at a Syracuse, they can look at a UNC, they can see the star power, they can see the variety in which they score goals. To me, that's a product of just kind of the skills and the freedom that those players operate within. But Princeton, you know, they have almost a different structure that they can put regardless of what the defense is doing. And I think, you know, that 13-11, 11-9, you know, kind of we're going to get the saves and then we're going to have just a little bit better of a variety with which we can score is how they're going to, you know, go to Memorial Day weekend. I really like their consistent, like their defensive identity to me is clearer than just about anybody else's. And that's going to be a point that, especially when we talk about Syracuse, I'm going to have some, you know, things to nitpick on, but it just seems like everybody is on the same page. Their cohesion on offense in different sets and defense defending different sets and a different caliber of star player. You know, I'm really, really high on Princeton, and it's going to take kind of a weird game to beat them where you have to change the tempo and the flow of the game to not fall into the 13-11 Princeton trap.
Yeah, statement made. I mean, it's very rare you get to see a coming out party. I thought Jack Stahl was just exceptional all weekend. The entire nation now is across his name and across the defensive side of the ball. And I also think we got to give credit to Madelon, Mitch, and that staff in the sense that they got their head kicked in at home against Penn State in the opener in a way that was stunning. Like, I had them going to the finals this year in our preseason tailgate podcast that Terry and I did in person at Gillette. I think they're exceptionally talented. Like, I think that their offense has 6 to 8 players who are dynamic and would play anywhere. I mean, they literally opened with 4 of the hardest games you can find. They stubbed their toe, and since then, right, I mean, they go to College Park and beat Tillman, coming off a loss, and then they, on a Friday, Sunday, they dominate Syracuse in a game that, frankly, the score actually makes it seem closer than it really was. Like, I thought Princeton looked elite in that first half. I thought Stahl on Spallina was a full blanket job for who, heading into the weekend, is the Vegas favorite to win the Tourathon. And then he follows that up 48 hours later with Duffy, and Princeton is now in an extremely productive position of having a secure RPI heading into a now softer portion of their schedule, candidly, not to chirp my own league. But they control their destiny. Like, the reality of Princeton this year, which I think most people would agree with, is they have very good goaltending and they have all of the pieces on offense that if this offense can get to a level of production that we saw, say, from Cornell last year, where they're putting in 15 a game, like, I think this D is good enough to carry the water. So Princeton's elite, man. Princeton's the real deal. I certainly won't be saying that when we play them in a month or two, but it was an impressive weekend.
So my relationship to a lot of teams and storylines is based on being the recipient of unsolicited texts from fans of those particular teams or observers, and then, because arguing is my nature, taking the opposite position. And because most of the people in my ecosystem that are Princeton lacrosse fans played for Bill Tierney and won 5 national championships in a row and gave up 5 goals a game, in their eyes, Princeton's defense has sucked ever since, which is just objectively not true. Like, off the top of my head, I think they were 8th in effective efficiency, adjusted efficiency last season. There was like commentary after the giving up, what was it, 13 or 14 to Penn State. They're like, oh yeah, same old bad Princeton defense. And I was like, what are you talking about? Same old bad Princeton defense. No, they were really good last year. One of the things that I want to talk about in the context of Jack Stahl is that in 2022, they had one of the most unique defensive personnel groupings, in the sense that due to the position flexibility, meaning the ability to play down low or up top, and injuries, based on my subjective opinion of watching their games, I thought that depending on the game, there were 5 different players over the course of the season that you could have said, outside of goalies or short 60 minutes, just long poles, that was the best defenseman in the game. George Bond, Andrew Song, Pace Billings, Ben Finley, and I believe Caffel Roberts. I don't think he was injured that year. Like, I think that each of those guys, maybe it was Colin Mulshine, stepped in as a freshman and had a good season or something, or a good game or something like that. But the point being that, you know, my contention was like, there was one, at least one game that each of those guys was like the best defenseman. Coming into this season, the graduation of Mulshine and Michael Bath was probably, like, you know, alongside the graduation of Coulter McAsee, like those were the two storylines that were interesting and or important when it came to figuring out who Princeton was going to be. Jack Stahl, who I think, generally speaking, has been an LSM over the course of his career, putting in these performances back-to-back against Joey Spallina and Doe and Duffy is really exceptional. Now, with that as pretext, Ryan Krotik got a lot of attention after the Maryland win because he made the game-winning save. However, he was still below 50%. He had 10 saves. The last one was the most important one. Coming into this weekend, he had stopped... He was ranked 64th in save percentage in Division I. Like, he was at like 43%. So to come out, and I believe he had 13 on Friday while letting 7 in, 66%, and then make 25 saves against the number one team in the country. Like, for everything that you want to say about Ryan Krotik, for everything you want to say about Jack Stahl, and he definitely deserves it, like, don't lose sight of Ryan Krotik, because it was, I mean, for as good as goalie performances, like, good goalie performances get the shine they deserve, like, it's possible that he's not going to get the shine that he deserves based on how well he played this weekend.
And it's one of those weird, you know, you never know what's going on in the mind of a goalie or the mind of a faceoff guy. And there are certain teams that I feel when the goalie gets hot, it trickles up either immediately or it kind of trickles up slower. And for Princeton, like, I thought, especially against UNC, I didn't see it as much against Syracuse, but with every save he was making, it just kind of seemed to give Princeton's defense a little bit more, hey, green light to go play like we know how to play. Let's play aggressive. Let's not play passive. And, you know, it forced UNC into a lot of interesting positions. You know, and when your goalie's hot, Larkin, you can speak to it probably a little bit better than me. It just kind of gives you that, hey, not only is this going to open up transition, not only is this going to open up me playing aggressively, like, even when you're getting ready to square up on someone and your goalie's hot, and I remember doing this with Jack Kelly when we were on the Outlaws, I'm like, dude, dodge me. Like, I don't care. I'm going to play good defense, and then it's going to be a save, and I'm going to talk my – do we say shit on this podcast?
Well, you just did, so yes.
Yeah, then I'm going to be in your ear. You know, it almost gave me a little extra in the tool belt to rattle the opposing offense.
I think we also just have to comment quickly on the Q's travel thing. Can I do 30 seconds on that?
Yeah, but let's just fully transition to Syracuse.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, so to set the scene, obviously, Q's goes on Friday, gets beaten by Princeton in an 11-7 final. Is that correct?
That's correct. And
then to their credit, massive trap game 2 days later. Very hard place to go, Franklin Field. I think people are broadly, think highly both of Taylor Ray long term and the potential he can build that program, but also short term. Like he's a bar fighter. Like he is a Calgary boy who will have his guys ready to go. I'm sure people have seen the viral clips of in the room or in the huddle from his St. Joe's years. Like he's got some fire. He's not necessarily a guy you want on 48 hours of sleep. And to their credit, they win 9-8, and I believe in overtime fashion.
Michael Leo, baby.
Michael Leo. And listen, let's just say it, because I know, you know, to their credit, massive fan base. I'm sure a lot of Syracuse fans listening. When they beat Maryland at home, based on the recent RPI precedent of where Maryland consistently sits at the end of the season, it was kind of totally fair to say Syracuse has written themselves, if they hold serve the rest of the way, into like a, let's call it, top four seed.
Right? Yep.
Because just based on the nature of their schedule, and even if they went, say, 500 in the ACC or whatever it is, they go to Cambridge and lose to Harvard. They go to Princeton and lose. I mean, their season effectively is on life support for the standards that they have, in the sense that they want not only to make the tournament, but to hopefully receive a draw that does not have a hard first-round game or a extremely difficult quarterfinal game. So I think, what did we learn about Syracuse? I'll pause there so that we can get the full panel involved, and then I would just like to comment on the travel piece because I find it so interesting. But Osello, go ahead.
I still, you know, and maybe it's because I genuinely or generally was not a huge fan of Syracuse and haven't been crazy high on them. But I see problems with their offense and problems with their defense. Now it's, you know, they held UPenn to 8 goals. So what are you even criticizing? But to me, you know, their defense is playing in tight. They are all on the same page, you know, speaking of how defense relates to, you know, good goaltending. Syracuse's defense is packing it in tight, which usually has two byproducts. One, you're more willing to give up outside shots. But two, that means that you can pay extra attention and make skip lanes more difficult, and it makes slide decisions. You take two steps and the slide man is already on the ball. What was interesting to me about Syracuse's defense is they're packing it in tight, but they're not necessarily sliding efficiently. You know, their slide man is not necessarily prepared. And by the time he makes that decision, that's how UPenn, I would argue, got most of their goals. And then as it relates to the offense, you know, it's that classic tug of war when you have the talent that you have on that field, how much structure versus how much freedom do you give them? And when Syracuse looks good, they look unbeatable, but their floor is so much lower than, say, a Princeton offense who uses variety and freedom. Almost the structure starts that freedom. Whereas Syracuse is just, hey, I don't know what sets they're running sometimes. And I don't know what they're trying to accomplish on offense other than get the good guy the balls and hope that it turns out good. And oftentimes it doesn't. I don't care how good you are. They're going up against some good defenses. And I think it's time to, you know, if I'm Gary Gate, I also had this thought, and, you know, I'm kind of just rambling now, but he's so good, you know, as a player. Is he telling guys to go make plays that he sees that nobody on earth can make? You know, there are some coaches who are so good at lacrosse. It's like, hey, don't listen to what Ryder Garnsey coaches you because no one's going to be able to do what he did. Not necessarily in Notre Dame, but that was a guy who gave me offensive advice. And I'm like, dude, don't tell me that because I can't do that. So some head scratching from
Chase. So let me address the Gary point first. I've said this on the podcast before. One of the kind of blessings of the position that I'm in at Inside Lacrosse is that I've had the player who was, if not his best player, then his left-handed goal scorer for 7, I believe, straight years, maybe 8. As a member of the Inside Lacrosse staff. So first Hallie Quillen and then Alyssa Murray. And so you know, I'm not, there are differences between, I'm sure, the way that he coached women's lacrosse and how he coaches men's lacrosse, but I don't think that the philosophy is different. And that was why I felt like when he was getting criticism in his first season for how stoic he was on the sideline, because I think a lot of fans correlate the activity level to quality coaching, when in reality, I've always been an advocate or of the opinion that, you know, what you do from 3 p.m. on Saturday to noon on Saturday, right, like the other 125 hours or however many hours there are in a week, outside of just the game window, matters commensurately more than the 2.5 hours that the game occurs. But it requires a lot of time. The way I characterize what Gary tries to do is he tries to pour the confidence that is innate in him for being the greatest player of all time into everybody on the roster, most especially the players that are most capable of approaching what he was able to do. And you can't do that in one season, which is why the growth that you were going to see from Joey Spallino was going to be like geometric as his career went along, because it was the playing golf together in September that was going to be just as meaningful for how they were going to get better. Now, with that being said, I want to address the other point that you made, Nick, which is the floor of Syracuse's performances. That to me is the greater source of concern than the fact that they're 4-2. Certainly if they were 3-3 heading to Homewood, we would be sounding alarm bells that are equivalent to the alarm bells that are being sounded in College Park, which we're going to get to here in a little bit. That win, very important from a stress pressure relief valve standpoint. But even with that, and even with a 20-2 win over St. Joe's in the Dome on your resume, I still don't feel like we've actually seen a good performance out of Syracuse, right? Even the Maryland game didn't feel like a good performance. It felt like a good win. It felt like a good Maryland win. It felt like Maryland pulled Syracuse into the deep end and Syracuse beat them in the way that Maryland likes to win games. And that's a good thing. You want to be able to have that muscle. And Larkin, maybe this is the perfect tee up to the point that you want to get to about their ability to play outside, because maybe it's just one of those things that, like, when the sun comes out and it's not cold and it's not miserable, that's when the high flying starts. But the Harvard game, like, it wasn't a high flying game. They Harvard effectively pulled Syracuse into the deep end.
I also want to give, you know, our analysis. I know we're hard on ourselves at times, but we set the table bringing up Joey Spallina as a true number one versus, say, a Jordan Wolf, and the reality of how the delta in that game can impact a roadmap for a defense to potentially shut down Syracuse. Joey Spallina got bageled on Friday night. Okay, how can you watch that game and not think that when Sean Light covers him, Notre Dame is going to be in a very advantageous position against Syracuse because of the nature of a lot of the questions in the preseason that we thought had potentially been answered against Maryland, which is how do they replace the Hiltz production? Are they good enough outside of just middies making athletic plays, beating short sticks, a Michael Leo or whoever it is? Because Joey Spallina grew up the son of a coach. He does not press. In a scenario in which other people need to make plays, you can get into a rock fight where it's 9-8 late against Penn, right? And I think it's a totally fair question. And I don't think we've seen the potential risk on either side, floor or ceiling. They definitely have not hit their ceiling, and I'm very nervous about their floor. So I just don't know what we have in Syracuse. And the point I want to make really quickly for people listening is the nuance of sport and home field advantage. There are sports where it makes a fundamental difference. In hockey, you get the last change. You can send your checking line out against Connor McDavid and put your pairing out. That is a true strategic advantage when you're at home. In football, with the crowd noise, they'll have to go on a hard snap and the DNs can time it up because they're going on like the leg rise of the guy next to the center. Like, there's actual differences. In lacrosse, there are none. Like, it is a turf field. It was 55, no wind at Princeton on Friday. Like, there is no reason Syracuse should not be fully prepared and ready to roll. And
they did not get off the bus.
And it's not Larkin just creating Twitter drama. They truly were unprepared in the first quarter to play as the, you know, unanimous number one like 10 days ago prior to them losing to Harvard, right? And I called it out when they went to Cambridge. Like, there's something to this the last 3 years under Gary where, and I think it really gets at the nature of what makes Q special, which is the dome has like a feel. It has a buzz. Like it's like seeing Tiger putting at Augusta. Like seeing Gary in the dome makes people feel a certain way.
He's going to love that analogy.
And it's just different. And they don't have that when they get off the Greyhound bus at class of 1952 stadium. So I think now this sets up a really interesting matchup. At Homewood, Hop coming off an emotional high, heading down to Clockner for that victory. And to be totally candid, folks, I think this is a lot tighter on paper edge than people think.
Yeah.
Like I think I expect this to be, you know, like 10-9 with both of their seasons on the line with respect to Final Four RPI complexity and like their path. I mean, this is a massive moment for Syracuse. Massive.
Especially because we haven't seen a dominating Johnny Mullen performance either, right? At least in the last couple of games. It feels like he's regressed a little bit. Especially, you know, it sounded on the broadcast like Joe Hobot was a potential game time decision against Virginia, which would suggest that, you know, it's likely he's going to make his return. And then obviously star of the week, Carter Krizak, is going to be playing with tremendous confidence. So Hopkins has a full boat that they can throw at Mullen. And I think that's the point that I meant to make when we were talking about these middling performances at each end of the field for Syracuse is that if Johnny Mullen's winning 70%, you don't need to be high-flying offensively and you don't need to be submarine buttoned up defensively and you're the number one team in the country. And I think that this is a natural segue into talking about Carolina as well because I guess just, you know, I think it's reasonable to say number one team in the country, going on the road, 2 games in 3 days, win the first game. You know, even if your aspiration is national championship, your aspiration is not going undefeated. Like this Carolina team is not, they're not good enough to think that this is the standard that we are aspiring to. So to go to 1952 against a team that many of us think might be the best in the country and have it tied in the fourth quarter and lose by two, can you go home and say, we're right where we want to be? And Larkin, I'll give it to you first.
Yeah, I don't think that's a crazy take. Like I think what you did a great job setting up is the Jacksonville film was horrific for a number one type team, right? We learned very little against High Point and Iona. I thought they showed fairly well against Hop, but we don't know what we have in Hop. Remember, this is a team that, yes, emotional victory over UVA. UVA might not be good. They got their head kicked in by Richmond, right? And UVA had that game in control in the third quarter. So we really didn't know what we had in UNC. Variance between their ranking and like, do we think this team can make a Final Four push? Because I think for most people, preseason, the path there, faster tempo, Duffy lights it up, 100 plus points this year, Dom shooting the lights out of the ball, D slightly improved, get enough saves. That's not really what we've seen yet. They go to Penn, find a way. Okay. And to your point, Terry, you could argue if you just wash the tape of the Penn State result, you could argue right now Princeton is firing on cylinders at a level that's realistically number one type quality in their own building. So yeah, I actually thought it was a decent weekend for UNC. And the big question for me with them is, can we do a better job? And I like this man. He's a Brown alum, so I want to support him, John Thompson. Can we do a better job of creating easy results for Duffy to find early flow and action? A lot of times his production comes from what is effectively like low razor ISO. So that's just he's really talented, which is super different than can we scheme high and away athletic midfielders to draw front side leverage to then create space for him where let's get him dunks. Like we need to get him into games where he has, you know, 3-3 and like you barely notice it versus kind of question marks and things of that nature. And by the way, that's what Pat March needs to do for Spolino as well. So I would say for both those guys. But I think Carolina leaves in a position where they actually have Brown this Saturday at home in a game they should win. I think Brown's trending. I think that's a trap game, frankly. And I think Torpy knows.
I agree. No, I agree.
Knows UNC a lot better than people realize because of the High Point connection. And we have a goaltender who, to the Kradic point earlier, he is elite. If Brown was a top 20 team, everyone would know who Connor Foley is. He gives us 65% every game. So massive trap game. And then they have Penn State, Army. And then I think it sets up a really interesting back-to-back of, well, I guess all three would be the Army, Harvard, Syracuse. Can they split? Can they go 2-2 in those? If they do, they're in a decent spot. But here's what I would say. I think UNC is a 5-15 club with a 1-4 ceiling. They are not there yet. We don't know what we have. So we'll see.
As far as where I land on, you know, can they go back after dropping in Princeton, winning at Penn, and saying this is where we want to be? I would say yes. And I think Larkin did a good job mentioning it, 5-15 with a 1-4 ceiling. UNC right now, I think, is one of the few teams that's identifying the areas which they need to get better pretty consistently. And I think Larkin nailed it. It's the offensive variety and where their players are comfortable playing. That's something that you can work on in practice. That's something that you can install a new set that has your playmakers getting comfortable in new areas of the field. That's something that they have two great sessions for film, particularly offensive film, against Penn and Princeton, saying here's what we succeeded and we can build on, and then here are some areas that we need to develop. Of all the teams that I would say, you know, are top five, I would argue that UNC has the easiest path to improvement, because there aren't the questions about floor ceiling that there are with Syracuse. You know, they've shown relatively consistent successes, relatively consistent moments of failure. And I think it's a much more linear path to improvement than other teams in the
game. I would agree, especially on the basis of the fact that their second midfield is exclusively freshmen. So maybe they hit the freshman wall, but until then you can build in a kind of certain, you know, a greater growth curve. And then same thing in goal, right? So I think there's a lot there. You know, quickly on Penn, Nick, you kind of went deep on them already, and we got to get to Notre Dame, Maryland. 2-3, 3-goal loss to Georgetown, 2-goal loss to Carolina, 1-goal overtime loss to Syracuse, first-year head coach. I kind of feel the same way about Penn as I do about Carolina, which is, you know, we can be disappointed in our record, but, you know, heading to Villanova with an opportunity to be 3-3, coming off of a you know, what would have been assessed in preseason as a tough non-conference schedule, maybe got a little lighter by virtue of Albany and Delaware's performances relative to preseason expectations. But, you know, starting the Ivy League slate with Harvard on March 14th at 3-3, if they can get a crosstown rival win in the bag, again, I think that, you know, you can like where you're at.
Yeah, they're not going to be an easy out all spring. For perspective, folks, they were picked to finish sixth in the Ivy this year, and they just took two ACC blue bloods that many people expect to be at Final Four championship weekend, like to the brink. So I think that says something about the quality of that league, and it also certainly says something about their roster quality in terms of they have high-end talent, and they're well-coached. And I think many people hope that, hey, it's Ray's first year. Maybe there'll be a down season. You know, if you're the Jerry Burns or the Shays, you can take advantage of that. It doesn't appear to be that way. So I expect, irrelevant to how they finish, I think they're going to be in close ball games all league play. They're rock solid.
I wouldn't want to see them on my schedule. But you know what else I don't want to see is the Big Ten Network getting the streaming rights to Notre Dame games. So we got to watch from the moon again. Haven't figured out how to get a camera a little bit closer. But Notre Dame goes into Maryland and comes away victorious. To me, this was exactly the game that you would have wanted to see if you're a Notre Dame fan. You know, I feel like I'm going back to a couple consistent points here, but the variety and the athleticism of the offense to me was the standout. You know, kind of earlier against the Marquettes, it was, all right, we're kind of trying to play this little high wing two-man game. We're having some success with it, but at the end of the day, I think Notre Dame's identity and its blood is, you know, we have stallions. You know, we recruit athletes. We have, you know, stud football players dating back to at least 2015, you know, that can beat their guy consistently and get a goal, but also make the right pass. You know, Brock Bearman, stud. Luke Miller, stud. Josh Yago, you know, physical and, you know, an incredible
player. Where'd he go to high school?
The depth of their he went to – well, actually, I think he went to Arvada West. But he played for Wheat Ridge for a little bit before their program started. Second best player to play at Notre Dame from the Wheat Ridge, Colorado area, arguably. And the only reason I'm not putting more stock in this game for Notre Dame is I am raising red flags about the goaltending situation in Maryland. There were a couple shots where I'm like, ooh, I don't know if that's the right shot. And more often than not, those went in. And against good goalies, it would have been, you know, probably save, push, transition immediately. Terry, Big Ten Network, what do you got?
Well, I got that it actually got on the internet waves, right? It occurred. So that's a plus.
Oh, I was hoping we were going to move on.
I was talking to Kevin Warren. I covered the Ohio State Georgetown game yesterday, and obviously Georgetown played Notre Dame, we think, last Sunday. And, you know, he asked what the Notre Dame Maryland score was, and I told him, and he's just like, he just gave me that kind of, you know, like that Notre Dame's a problem type of reaction. And somebody told me a couple years ago, in the context of either a recruiting ranking or who we were picking for the Senior All-America game, if Kevin Warren thinks he's going to be a good defenseman, he's going to be a good defenseman. Like, he has a 9.99 rate, like hit rate. And that I'm just protracting that over the assessment of the composition that he plays as well. The fact that Jalen Seymour is just not the linchpin, orient everything around. Like if Jalen Seymour played for Notre Dame in 2014, he would have been Sergio Perkovic, right? There is so little difference between, like, his physique and his skill set. And yet he had one goal against Maryland, right? Ho-hum. Yeah, Brock Mirabin and Luke Miller are, in some ways, I think, the beneficiaries of the insane athleticism that Will Angrick and Teddy Lally and Matt Jeffrey bring around them. And, like, they are the skill that makes that athleticism be able to be a little less skilled. And then the athleticism is what allows those guys to be a little bit less athletic and still pour in, like, 5.5 points a game or whatever they averaged. So, I am going to rank Carver number one this week because I had them there last week. And even though, you know, they didn't get off to the fastest start against Marquette on Long Island, it's not enough for me to drop them down. But Notre Dame's the best team in the country. And, you know, there's just no question about it in my mind. And that's not a discredit to Richmond. I think Richmond, if we're making the superlative argument, Richmond has the fewest holes of any team in the country, and that can correlate to winning a championship. But Notre Dame is the best team in the country. Larkin, would you rather talk about the Fighting Irish, or would you rather talk about exactly how loud the fire alarms are going off in the CQ Fieldhouse Center in the shadow?
Talk about both. I have no idea why you're ranking Harvard one. They beat a Cuse team that can't travel at home and haven't beat anybody else. How's Notre Dame?
Yeah, Terry.
Is that not a little bit of confirmation bias? Because at the time they beat the number one Cuse team. Now Cuse, we know, is like, okay.
I don't like that to me. I understand the logic of saying we thought your Q swing was X valuable. It turns out it was Y valuable, but it's not Harvard's responsibility to make sure that Syracuse wins the subsequent two games. I mean, is Notre Dame's Maryland win that good? Is Notre Dame's Georgetown win that good? Georgetown just lost yesterday to Ohio State. Right. So, like,
I think pound for pound, the net sum of Georgetown Maryland victories over what we now know is a beating Cuse at home by one in a game Cuse very well could have won. Right. That to me means more. I think if Harvard goes and pumps Michigan in Houston, then they have a far stronger case because Michigan, we know, is solid. Like, we just haven't learned anything from Providence, Colgate, or Marquette, in my opinion.
Yeah,
I think Harvard's good. I don't think they're elite, but I think they're good.
Well, so based on the logic that I used last week, which is best win on the board, right now Princeton should be number one because they have the best win on the board, because a win over Carolina is the best win, right? Like, they deserve to be the highest ranked non-undefeated team. But yeah, it's just not how – it's not the method that I use used since 2008.
I guess just quickly on Notre Dame, I think what should be scary for the country is this roster screams – kind of the 2012-17 era of Notre Dame when you guys almost won that year over Berge Osella, not to bring up bad memories, but athletic poles on the back end with an elite cover one. Like four D mids, I don't actually know their names, but they're all like freaks and would be the most athletic guy on like 60% of the teams in the country. And offensively, I think they'll be able to get 10 plus. So put differently, the Kavanaugh era with the young guys led to this, you know, explosion where they were like putting in 20 and kind of playing high flying. Like, Notre Dame used to be damn good at winning games 10-8. And like, right. Kevin Corrigan is extremely comfortable in that paradigm. So yeah.
10-8 is generous. It was like 5-2.
Yeah. Yeah. And
it was bad.
And what should be scary is like, they didn't even get saves out of Richie Ardelli, right? Like, he was under 50. I just want to jump to kind of like, what I think is the thesis break for Maryland. So, like, if you just put away all the noise, like, of course we can fall back on, do I think Tillman's going to coach the heck out of this group and get them going? Sure. Do I think they're going to make a run in the Big Ten? Probably. If not, almost guaranteed. I think the thesis break is late clock when they were at the Dome against Cuse, they didn't really have an athletic dodging attackman who could generate – kind of like front side movement, so that just to create space for everyone else. And the questions at the time were, is Spanos hurt, right? The questions were, can Lyons and Johnson be enough? And I remember raising my hand and I was like, it's kind of crazy that they're giving the ball late clock to a guy who didn't even dodge at Yale. Like, Chris Lyons was an off-ball finisher on the righty half wall with Matt Brando behind the net, right? And so I think it's just as simple as, like, Maryland's really good. Like, Larkin, Schaller, they have a lot of pros on that roster, and they are exceptionally well coached. I just don't know if they have a dog pile on Memorial Day quality initiator. And, you know, what's going to be very fascinating, just to jump to probably the crux of this, is for the first time in a decade, they may be a 6-8 seed, if not a traveling opening round seed, which makes them – coaches are going to be praying that whoever is the Donna this year – does not send the Terps to – imagine you're like Harvard, you were in the 2 seed, and you get Maryland. So, yeah, we'll see. I mean, they're 1-3, and the Big Ten, the RPI, the Big Ten clubs, when they win those games, is not going to be as strong as other years.
Yeah, so they're not like, going to get that compounding benefit that they sometimes do.
Like, undefeated from here on out, right? Does that have them at 7 in RPI? Does that have them at 10? I don't know, but it's just – They immediately become the like, oh God, we do not want Tillman. I would put them as they're in the 4-8 bucket. They are certainly not bad. Their floor is high, but they're not 1 or 2 right now. And that's shocking to a lot of people. Yeah.
The Molly, that's enough. The reason why I would put more stock into it, I'm an alumni, but B, Maryland going 15-23 and getting 12 saves and still not really having a material impact on the game. That to me says, watch out. This is a scary Notre Dame team. And I, you know, it's been a long time. It's been like 2 years since I've felt this. So I got to say, it's pretty good to be back.
Larkin, Richmond 8, Cornell 7. The Big Red, defending national champs, sustain their first loss since, I don't even remember when, Penn State, right? In March of 2025. And it was Joe Sheridan with 2 goals and 2 assists. And what is even more impressive about the win for the Spiders, in my opinion, is Matt Tully made 16 saves. So he was at 67%. This game could have been tilted even more in Richmond's direction. We already talked about they have a very good, solid case for a number one spot in the Kane media poll. Can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Yeah, it was a rock fight. I actually to maybe go contrarian, I actually thought Cornell showed pretty well. I think a lot of people anticipated Richmond potentially heading up there and perhaps announcing to the country that Cornell is not who they were with CJ Kirst. I want to give Connor and his staff credit. I thought Cornell had a great plan to limit Richmond's offense. You know, they got enough out of Little John and company. But the reality is, I mean, you hold what many people believe is, let's call it a top 5 to 8 efficiency offense in the country to 8 goals at Chulkoff. Like, you expect to win that game. So I thought Cornell had a good plan. I thought that Richmond's defense and the potential talent out of a few of their cover athletes is, I think, what a lot of people in the media are going to start doing homework on. I thought they showed quite well against Goldstein and Firth. Connor's extremely well prepared. Like, Cornell has a great east-west plan. They do a good job setting picks. It's no different than playing Pat March or Mitchell or whoever. Like, it doesn't really matter who's playing ultimately. Like, Cornell is, they are well prepared on offense. So I thought this was a win that Richmond can hang their hat on. And ultimately, as we all know, when you are in the conference they are, if you stumble out of con, it can have dramatic ripple effects on your seeding. And for a team that wants to make their first ever appearance on championship weekend, they're not getting anything out of beating, you know, UMass or Hobart or Delaware in the A-10 in terms of, like, going from a 2 to a 6 or vice versa, right? So this is the type of game where you go on the road to Cornell. You know, it's a game that many people expect Cornell to do well in the Ivy and be in the top 20 in RPI. I mean, this is massive for Richmond's trajectory and to have a tailwind. And now this sets up a very interesting contest this Saturday against Kevin Warren and Georgetown, because if you were going to build a guy and, like, an identity to potentially disrupt a lot of what the Spiders stand for, and obviously with the history in recent results, like, I think a lot of people are going to be very, very curious how they show against that Georgetown defense and whether they can kind of look the part.
Nick, you got anything on Richmond Cornell before I get us going on Georgetown Ohio State to wrap this thing up?
No, just I love the way Richmond plays. They're a team that, you know, we were talking about it with Hopkins earlier, but they never considered themselves out for even a second. I will actually agree with Larkin's point that Cornell looked pretty good, particularly the way that Goldstein and Firth can, you know, mess with their defenders from at or behind GLE. You know, when submarine cuts happen and the pass is going up the field towards that submarine cut, they execute that at a very high level of efficiency. And that's a unique enough look to give every defense problems. But for, you know, to go into, you know, a face-off matchup against Cascaden and come out victorious and, you know, going over 60%, it just seemed like everything from the offense continuing to believe, from the face-off, from the transition, you know, even when they had bad moments, their ability to bounce back on the next possession as opposed to the next quarter has really impressed me. I have Richmond at number 2 this week.
Outside the box take here, but I just need to comment on it. We as a sport need to do a better job holding refs accountable for backup decisions. Cornell should have had the ball with 4 to 3 seconds left. It was not even close. I hate the fact that refs bail out offenses and bad shots by, if it's not dramatically clear that the pull is closer, the tie often goes to the offense. And that's not how the rule's written. Like, it is closest to the ball when it goes out. And the difference in that game, I think Connor ends up calling timeout with maybe 15 seconds left, and Firth has to dodge in that near side alley and just jam crease, versus if they had gotten the ball with 45. So little things like that are so frustrating for me because of how hard a defense has to work. And, like, missing the net is a decision, and you need to reward the defense if they do everything right and back that ball up. So I don't know who the ref was in that game, but big mistake there.
One of the decisions that gets made when you miss the net is if you're trying to avoid a enormous goalie who can cover up every corner of the net, like Caleb Fiak, who made 8 saves and allowed just 2 goals in the first half of Ohio State's 10-9 win over Georgetown. That is one of the things that creates some problems. And this was not a game that hinged on shot backups, but it was one that hinged on pipes. Kevin felt like they hit maybe 5, 6. The box score said 3, but I'm not going to dispute it. And certainly after Garrett Haas gave him the go-ahead goal with less than 2 minutes to go. Jake Bickle, freshman midfielder out of Malvern, got a step, and he hit the pipe as hard as I've seen any game-winning shot hit a crossbar, maybe ever. And ultimately, Ohio State was able to run it out. It was an interesting game. I think each guy had a compelling comment post-game. Nick Myers really... I thought the thing that he said that was most interesting was he felt like his team was nervous. They started 5-0. This was a very clear step up in competition. The last time they had played a top 10 quality opponent was against Carolina in scrimmages, and they had lost. And so I think, he was like, we committed 5 turnovers in the first quarter. They also committed 5 turnovers in the second quarter, even though they built a 3-2 halftime lead. And, not only is it interesting, in my opinion, for a coach to say he felt like his team was nervous, I think it's also even more interesting to say that he felt like they were nervous because of the step in quality competition. So I thought that was really compelling. And then, with respect to, the Georgetown side of things, what Kevin really harped on was the improvement from last week to this week. And, I can't speak to it because we didn't see the Notre Dame game. But with that being said, to the point that you made, Larkin, they get the opportunity to play spoiler and put the best win on the board, going forward, right? And if they beat Richmond, it surpasses Princeton's win over North Carolina as the best win, the best, pelt on the wall, so to speak, in college lacrosse. And I came away thinking that they are good enough to do it. I think Ohio State is really interesting. I think it's the first time I've seen Garrett Haas in person. He is very fast. He has the athletic profile of a number one attackman. And he and Alex Marinier are the formed identity. The other four spots in the field, even Liam White, who I think is the probably best initiating midfielder, slide drawer, move the ball guy, finished with, I believe, 2 assists. Even his role, I feel like, is still maybe not evolving, but could be fluid depending on matchup, circumstance, time and score, all that stuff. Ohio State has maybe the firmest identity defensively because of what Caleb Fayok is and because of what Colin Brown is. Certainly they, took a hit in the preseason with Bobby Van Buren's injury, but, losing a number one lockdown defender who is arguably the best defender in the country has, maybe taken them from the number one, two, maybe three defense to the number six, seven defense. They haven't fallen off a cliff outside the top 20 or anything like that. And then they have a little bit of a core that has a lot of options around it in terms of who they can be offensively. So we can start to, put our arms around who Ohio State's going to be. And when they take on Notre Dame in Columbus this weekend, that's going to be another telling fact. I guess I should say that Georgetown's opportunity to put the best win on the board might persist for like 2 hours, because I think that Ohio State Notre Dame game is a 2 o'clock start. So the Buckeyes potentially have the opportunity to surpass it in very short order afterward. But with Georgetown, because Liam and Rory Connor are new, shout out to Hayden Cody, the freshman faceoff guy who came on for Ross Prince, who got knocked out in the second half of that Notre Dame game and did a really nice job, especially early. Ohio State battled back with their own freshman faceoff guy. I believe Matt Mayfield is his name. And then not just Bickle, but also Natty Mason got a freshman midfielder, got the first goal of his career. It's just a Georgetown team that's coming together. We know who Ty Banks and Anderson Moore are, but then obviously we know who the offense is going to be, but there's a difference between seeing the Connors perform in Colgate uniforms versus in Georgetown uniforms. And now we've got a growing sample now of 3 games of that. So anybody got any thoughts on Hoya's Buckeyes?
No, other than, and Larkin will probably get more detailed, but this game was also, it certainly wasn't Hopkins, Virginia, but it was fun. And, the first quarter was a bit of a, kind of a snooze fest, Fayok playing really good, Ohio State's offense playing really bad. Kind of was a immovable object meets a car that didn't have any gas in it. But when that second half hit, man, that was that was really fun lacrosse. And that goal where, you know, Ohio State dodges to the middle, passes to the crease, it goes off the helmet, flies up into the air, and then it's dinged into the net.
Shout out, Brad Sharp.
I would say were it not for Hopkins, Virginia, this would be a great game to go back and rewatch at least the second half of, because it just was a fun collegiate sporting event.
Yeah, the last thing I would add is Georgetown plays in the Big East. Like, they can always back their way into the tournament through the automatic qualifier. They just need to keep getting better. I thought they took a step. Like, I thought they showed actually quite well. And the beauty of next weekend is all, for all four of those teams, which we've done a good job setting the table. I mean, we're going to learn a lot. You know, we're going to learn a lot by you know, this time next Sunday.
Great. So great note to end on. This was the best weekend of the regular season. It was awesome. What can you say?
Oh,
this is why we do it, fellas.
It was so fun.
It's March.
Well, and it's not over. It's not over, because I'm getting ready to go watch the second half of College of Idaho playing Eastern Oregon, which it's disgusting that you guys weren't paying attention to that, going to watch my boy Henry Harris ball out for the Coyotes of College of Idaho.
Let's go. Love you, Nick.
Love you, Terry.
Love you, Larkin. Larkin.